The following exchange between a comedian and the President of the United States actually happened just this week. Seth Meyers, can you confirm or deny that there is an active conspiracy between you and Ms. Swift? President Biden, where are you getting this information? It's classified. That's classified information.
Right, so there's the deep state causing the football game to be rigged. And then on the other hand, there's the long tradition of celebrity conspiracy theories.
Well, we have a long tradition of that.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, there's lots of conspiracy theories about celebrities who died suddenly who actually aren't dead. So Elvis is alive. Tupac is alive. Conversely, that Paul McCartney is dead and that he was replaced with some sort of body double back in the 1960s. Right. Yes. McCarthy believed that Hollywood was, well, not just McCarthy. There was actually the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was separate from McCarthy, had a lot of hearings saying that Hollywood was, using its power to shape minds by putting out propaganda, communist propaganda in the movies. I mean, I thought when Barack Obama was elected and he said, I'm going to be fully transparent, I thought, oh, well, that's the end of conspiracy theories because people won't have anything to worry about because government's going to be transparent. And in fact, that was another inflection point when things got even crazier.
Did you know that World War I was a major turning point for America's history of conspiracy theories? You see, before World War I, conspiracy theories targeted minorities and marginalized groups. But after World War I, conspiracy theories became about our government, about the deep state. Hey there, news peelers. Today is February 28th, 2024, and this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars, enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee, or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. This week, President Biden made an appearance on NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers, where he addressed concerns about his age and joked about the mega-led Taylor Swift / Kelce conspiracy theory. Basically, the gist of this conspiracy theory is that the U.S. Department of Defense, the DOD, has recruited Ms. Swift to help Mr. Biden win the 2024 presidential election. And get this, 18% of us Americans actually believe this conspiracy theory. This is according to Monmouth University survey, the results of which were published in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days after the Super Bowl. And according to the New York Times, this particular conspiracy theory was promoted in January by Jesse Waters, who, as you well know, is a political commentator and host on Fox News. Per Mr. Waters, 4 years ago during a NATO meeting, NATO as in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the DOD psychops suggested the idea of recruiting Taylor Swift. Maybe President Biden wasn't joking in Seth Meyers' show. Perhaps this is really classified information. You know, I'm always a sucker for a good news story, but this Taylor Swift conspiracy theory is just so outlandish that I've stopped paying attention, stopped reading about it. But I've dropped links to the articles I mentioned, as well as others, so you can read them if you wish. Regardless of whether or not we want to indulge in these stories, the reality is that conspiracy theories, really wild conspiracy theories, have been around for ages, and some have proven to be true. In this episode, my guest, Dr. Catherine Olmsted, a professor at the History Department of UC Davis, takes us through the history of America's conspiracy theories. She's the author of many books on this subject, including two books that we discuss: Challenging the Secret Government, the Post-Watergate Investigations of the CIA and FBI, and another book is Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. You can visit her academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Olmsted and I peel the history behind this news. Was the ancient Middle East a troubled region? How about the people of the ancient Middle East? Did they commit random acts of violence, like our modern version of mass shootings? I spoke to Dr. Amanda Padani at Unraveling the Middle East podcast about effective diplomacy in the ancient Middle East, before the age of empires, before foreign powers interfered in the Middle East. We also talked about the people of ancient Middle East. What were they like? Their careers, their concerns, their habits, their families. Were ancient Middle Easterners a kind people? I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Dr. Padani, which will be available on March 1st. Now, let's start our conversation with Dr. Olmsted about America's conspiracy theories. Dr. Olmsted, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. I want to speak with you about your book, which is titled Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. But before we go to your book, I'm wondering, are there any notable conspiracy theories from, say, 1789, the birth of our republic, to 1914, which is the year World War I started, that you'd like to highlight for us that sort of stands out for you?
Oh, sure. It's not that conspiracy theories suddenly start in the United States in 1914. There are many, before that. Indeed, you could say that there are conspiracy theories in English-speaking North America going back to the first time that English colonists set foot on the continent. So even before the birth of the United States, it's just that in the early days up through the, say, the early 20th century, most conspiracy theories in the English colonies and then in the United States had to do with marginalized groups or minority groups. So that, for example, the United States was mostly Protestant. So there were conspiracy theories about Catholics, about Jews. In the 19th century, there are conspiracy theories about Mormons. Also conspiracy theories about racial groups, about enslaved people, about Native people, about immigrants. So lots of conspiracy theories in the early days about this fear of the other, that there are these different racial, ethnic, religious groups that are sneaking into America and going to harm the native-born white Protestants.
And it's interesting, as you identify some of these groups, Jews, Catholics, Mormons, Natives, immigrants, and enslaved Blacks, they probably didn't have as much access to, let's say, media and newspapers to counter these conspiracy theories. Am I close to the mark here?
Right. Well, I mean, there are conspiracy theories that are spread by word of mouth even before the invention of the printing press. You could go back to medieval Europe and there's the blood libel against Jews. But certainly as as more people are reading and there's more print media circulating, then there's more conspiracy theories. And yes, of course, it's harder for marginalized groups to have access to those media to counter them.
So the period covered by your book starts from World War I in 1914 and goes to 9/11. Was World War I a turning point?
Yes, I think it was. It's a turning point because it's at that point in U.S. history that we start seeing a lot of conspiracy theories about the U.S. government.
Oh, okay.
So for a long time before that, you had conspiracy theories, but Americans were saying, oh, it is the immigrants that are trying to overthrow the government, or it is the Catholics who have allegiances to the Pope who are trying to overthrow the American experiment. But what happens starting in World War One is that's when you get a U.S. government that that starts to expand, has a lot more power, and also has the power to surveil dissidents. So Congress passes the Espionage and Sedition Acts in 1917 and 1918 that effectively
during World War One.
During World War One, yeah. So it's then that the U.S. government effectively criminalizes dissent. You know, you're not allowed to make speeches that undermine the war effort. And so there are not only these laws, but then there are also these intelligence agencies in the Justice Department, in the military, that start spying on Americans to collect information about, are they opposing the war? And so it's exactly this point in history when the U.S. government gets enough power and capability to spy on American citizens that Americans start to have conspiracy theories about the government. And they start to say, no, I'm not so much worried about, you know, I still am worried about immigrants.
Yeah.
But really, the real threat to democracy is not other people. It is the government that we have, in fact, elected.
That is interesting. Just 2 points I'm wondering. And pardon me if they're irrelevant. What I'm wondering that in that decade of 1914 and the 1910s, taxation also came to be, which did that have any factor sort of tick off Americans? Now they're taxing us.
Yes. Although, you know, the income tax doesn't affect that many people at the beginning. It's mainly affects the very high income levels.
Oh, that's right. That's
right. So the war is mostly financed by Liberty bonds. So people voluntarily loan mm-hmm. the government money. But I think certainly the start of the income tax is important because it lays the foundation for a state that is going to grow.
How about
the state grows, people begin to suspect it of various crimes.
How about prohibition, the amendment for prohibition, or the amendment which gave women the franchise, the right to vote? Did they sort of rub some men, conservative men, in a weird way, funny, and conspiracy theories start out of that?
Well, prohibition is certainly a sign that the U.S. government is gaining more power. Makes it illegal to manufacture or sell alcoholic beverages throughout the United States. So that's a really strong government, really strong state intervention in society and economy.
Telling you what you cannot drink at home, right?
Right. Well, I mean, if you had already bought it before prohibition and you had it at home, you could drink it at home. But, yeah. You know, certainly there's a vast expansion of government power. I don't think the suffrage amendment was quite as important, although it is mm-hmm. showing federal supremacy because it's telling the states that they can no longer discriminate against women in the franchise.
Yeah. So what are some notable conspiracy theories between World War One and 9/11?
Well, I mean, that's a big
period. Yeah. Yeah.
But you start with conspiracy theories about World War One. People who oppose the war or who after the war come to see it as a mistake think that the U.S. was tricked into joining the war by a combination of the British and bankers who had loaned money to the British and wanted to make sure they got paid back, and arms manufacturers for obvious reasons, that there was a conspiracy among those various groups. And so those are the conspiracy theories about World War One. There's conspiracy theories about World War Two, that Franklin Roosevelt knew the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor and deliberately withheld that information from the commanders at Pearl Harbor because he wanted to get into a war against the Nazis, who were allied with the Japanese.
That would be pretty audacious.
It would be, yes, it would be extremely complicated.
Yeah.
As well. There's no evidence for it at all.
I'm wondering, did that Pearl Harbor conspiracy theory start developing immediately afterwards, or is this sort of a retrospective development years later?
Well, it goes through a couple of phases. There are actually during the war, there mm-hmm. are some people that are on the far right in American politics. They hate.
Would that be Republican right? Is that?
Yeah, Republican right. Mm-hmm. Although certainly not the mainstream of the Republican Party. Okay. And the far right of the Republican Party, isolationists, they didn't want to get into the war. And so once the U.S. is in the war, they say, well, how did this happen? It can't be that I was wrong. It has to be that, you know, we are in the wrong war against the wrong enemy. We should really be fighting the communists, not the fascists. So how did this happen? Well, it must be because there's a liberal president who, you know, manipulated us into the war. So those actually start communicating with one another, various far right intellectuals and activists during the war. They don't publicize it, though, because it would be very unpopular during the
war. Very unpatriotic.
Right. But after the war, then they do start publishing Pearl Harbor conspiracy theories.
These people that came up with the Pearl Harbor conspiracy, they're not necessarily Nazi sympathizers, right?
No, although some of them do become Holocaust deniers. So
really,
you know, yeah, there definitely is an affinity there, where at a minimum they think, you know, Hitler's not really a threat to us. Why are we at war with him? And as I say, they're on the extreme right, so they want to go to war with the Soviet Union. So they say, how on earth did we end up in a war fighting Nazis and allied with communists? It must be a big plot.
Does the Pearl Harbor conspiracy theory continue to this day?
Well, it does, although it's different. So as they say,
In what sense is it different?
Well, it was a far-right conspiracy theory at the beginning. Uh-huh. And you can see publications that espouse it through the 50s, then it sort of dies down. Then it reemerges in the 1970s after Watergate, but it's no longer a far-right conspiracy theory. It's more sort of politically neutral, with various conspiracy theorists after Watergate saying, well, Watergate was an example of a president conspiring against the public. Let's look for other examples in the past.
Yeah.
Roosevelt in World War II also conspired against the public.
Interesting. And now in the 2020s and the 2010s, is Pearl Harbor sort of a conspiracy theory for history nerds? Because I see it once in a while on social media. I'm like, what? We're still discussing this?
Right. Well, I mean, it doesn't have any support among academic historians. So it doesn't even have the kind of support where some people would say, like with the Kennedy assassination, gosh, really don't know what happened there.
Yeah.
Definitely there's agreement in historians that Roosevelt did not know about that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor on December 7th. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that is popular because it's the kind of conspiracy theory where people like to say, well, I know more than you do.
You
know about World War II, but I actually know the truth.
Having a couple of drinks and then these things come out. That's really interesting. So moving forward from Pearl Harbor, one of the big ones, obviously, is JFK. Is there anything else that stands out before that? In the 50s?
Well, in the 50s, it's anti-communist conspiracy theories. Joe McCarthy, that there are communists in the U.S. government who are secretly manipulating foreign policy to benefit the Soviets.
All of these are against the government. And you already said this in the beginning of our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean Americans as a whole had less confidence in our government?
Well, all of these, I think they show distrust of government decisions in war. So in World War I, it was the people who opposed U.S. entry into World War I who thought there was a conspiracy. in World War II. It's the people who opposed entry into World War II who thought there was a conspiracy. In the 1950s, there's this generalized fear in the nuclear era that there are secret enemies within who are going to cause America to lose a war against the Soviets. So you see these, periodic concerns about war decisions and this assumption by Americans who oppose a war that they must have been tricked into joining that war. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't say, though, that it necessarily reflects widespread distrust of government. It reflects distrust of government of this one subset who opposes U.S. involvement in a war.
A very vocal subset.
Right. Well, especially by the 1950s. Yes, it's very, very vocal.
Yeah.
And it's after the Vietnam War that you really start to see where they have scientific polling that shows that there's a big loss of trust, steady loss of trust from the 1960s throughout the end of the 20th century up to our own time. As more and more Americans come to distrust the federal government.
Has that been gradually going up, or has it been like up and down?
Well, it's up and down, but the overall trend line is down.
You mean confidence is down overall?
Confidence is down, yes.
Interesting. So we get over McCarthy's witch hunt, the Red Scare and the communist scare in the 1950s, and we're slammed with JFK's assassination.
Right.
And there's
yes. I mean, it's ready made for conspiracy theories because, of course, it's very traumatic to have your president shot.
Yeah.
But then also the alleged assassin is killed 2 days later. And so this opens up a lot of questions. So there's people from the beginning, maybe close to 50%, who say, I'm not sure we know the whole story. Goes down to maybe 40% of people who believe there's a conspiracy theory. But then by the 1970s, as more information comes out about the CIA working with the mafia to kill Fidel Castro, more and more people start to think that there's connections there, that we don't know everything. And so the percentage that believe in a Kennedy conspiracy theory goes way up to almost, well, more than 80% at times.
Oh, wow. CIA working with mafia. I have a whole section to speak with you about the CIA, so I'm going to leave that there. Let's see. With respect to JFK, is this the sort of conspiracy theory that rallied people towards the government initially? Or is it the sort of conspiracy theory that sort of added on to our lack of confidence? Kind of 9/11 rallied people towards the government, right?
Right.
That's my perspective. I wasn't around when JFK was shot.
Right. Well, I would say there's a little bit of a similar trajectory in that it certainly rallies people around the government. It makes them feel very patriotic. They want to support Lyndon Johnson, the new president, at the beginning. But over time, there are more questions that emerge. And so that there is increasing distrust.
I see.
And, it's similar in 9/11. There's a rallying around the flag at the beginning. Then a few years later, as the Iraq war doesn't go well and there are more questions raised about why the U.S. went to war in Iraq, then there start to be more and more people who question what really happened at 9/11.
Do you think there were more sort of virulent conspiracy theories back in the Vietnam era about the Vietnam War than the Iraq War? I asked that because between 50 to 55,000 Americans died in Vietnam. That was a much bigger loss than Iraq and Afghanistan combined.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say more virulent, but certainly that's a large chunk of the people who believe in Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories is they think that Kennedy would have taken the United States out of Vietnam. And so he was killed to stop him from doing that.
Oh, wow. That's the reason they think that he was killed. Do you have any inside stories to share with us? Do you have the answer about who killed JFK?
No, I do not.
We'll be back after a short break to talk about the post-Watergate investigations of the CIA and the FBI.
You can put a face to these podcasts by visiting our YouTube channels, youtube.com/@historybehindnews, and also youtube.com/@unraveling the Middle East. I've also dropped links to these YouTube channels below. Now, let's get back to peeling the history behind our news.
Dr. Olmsted, in preparing for this conversation with you, I noted another book of yours. It is titled Challenging the Secret Government, the Post-Watergate Investigations of the CIA and FBI. And you and I talked about the CIA in the last segment a little bit. I would love for you to share the story behind this book with us, please.
Sure. So my book, Challenging the Secret Government, is about the investigations of American intelligence agencies after the Watergate scandal. So Richard Nixon resigned in 1974 after the Watergate scandal, and Americans learned at the end of the Watergate scandal that the Nixon reelection committee had been systematically spying on its opponents, that it had paid for this espionage with illegal campaign contributions, and that the president had personally directed a cover-up of these events. And so once he left office and all of this was proven with the Watergate tapes, there was pressure on Congress to investigate whether there was anything more. You know, was the Watergate scandal just a one-off? Was it just Nixon? Or in fact, had secret agencies in the U.S. government been committing similar crimes and abuses of power before Nixon?
That's big.
Yeah. Wow. And it's really quite a remarkable story, because then there was a Democratic Congress and they decided to investigate.
Okay. Were Republicans on board with this?
The Republicans were on board. They served on the committees. There was a committee in the House and then a committee in the Senate, which is the better known one. It was headed by a senator named Frank Church. So it's often called the Church Committee. Mm-hmm. And these investigations lasted more than a year, and they had subpoena power, and they had these sensational hearings when they subpoenaed the leaders of the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and they investigated going back to the beginning of the Cold War. So this is almost 30 years at that point in history. And tried to find out if these agencies had broken the law or if they had abused the trust of the American people. Some people at the time suggested they were like truth commissions, you know, like
in truth in commissions.
Yeah. When you have a revolution against an authoritarian government and the new democratic government comes in and says, let's investigate. Mm-hmm. This is essentially what the Church Committee and other similar investigations in Congress were doing, was saying, you know, let's find out, let's discover if our government committed crimes against the people. And the motivation there was very idealistic. Oh, they thought, especially the leaders of these investigations, that it's really important that the American people know if their government has lied to them, has committed crimes against them. We need to throw open the closets and, you know, find all the skeletons and admit our sins. And then going forward, make sure that these sort of things don't happen again. And
that seems so naive. doesn't it? We're talking about a government. I mean, there are a lot of secrets. I mean, it's a good thing, but you know, you said it's idealistic, and it does sound idealistic. I'm wondering, these people that were running the church commission, what was their political motivation? Were they just looking good in front of their constituents? Is that it?
Well, some people thought that Senator Church definitely did begin to run for president in 1976. He didn't, he didn't go anywhere. But I mean, that was the political climate of 1975, that you could think that maybe you could get elected president in 1976 by exposing the crimes of the CIA and FBI.
So when you say since, that sounds so similar to the last few years of our lives right here. When you say sensational hearings, so was this in the nightly news? Was it in the newspapers daily?
Yes, it was in the newspapers daily. It was in just about all of the hearings were covered on the nightly news, because they uncovered, among other things, with the FBI, they uncovered an FBI program called COINTELPRO, which was
That, please. What was it called?
COINTELPRO. This was FBI surveillance of American dissidents, various groups. Most of them on the left, although one was on the right, the Ku Klux Klan. But the FBI systematically spied on these various American groups, including the civil rights movement, especially.
Oh, including the civil rights movement.
Yeah. Especially Martin Luther King was personally targeted. And so there were all those revelations about the FBI, also with the CIA, that it had tried to kill foreign leaders, and most notably had worked with the mafia to try to kill Fidel Castro.
So with respect to the CIA, just to be clear, they weren't investigating anything that CIA may have done in the U.S. because the CIA doesn't have jurisdiction in the U.S., right?
Well, the assassination plots were not in the U.S. There was another CIA program that they investigated where the CIA was illegally spying on Americans in the United States.
It was?
Yeah.
Did that cause, I don't know, a lot of heads to roll in the CIA? Firings or?
No, I mean, it was historical. So by this point, the people who had known about it were no longer in power. And by the time it all came out, there was no appetite to prosecute CIA officers. And in addition, in that case, the presidents had told the CIA to do this, knowing that it was illegal. The presidents had lost faith in the FBI. So you had first President Johnson and then President Nixon telling the CIA to do this domestic espionage.
Just for our audience's clarification and perhaps my own, when we talk about the FBI at that time, you're saying LBJ and then later Nixon, this is still the FBI of Edgar Hoover, right? Who had files on pretty much everybody.
Right. He was the director for almost 50 years and he died in 1972.
Okay, so into Nixon's almost second term or end of his first term or something like that.
End of his first term.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So when you look at the FBI, they uncovered FBI program COINTELPRO, spying on the left, far left, let's say communist groups and KKK. I'm not getting into the legal aspect of it. Just politically speaking, that wouldn't cause an uproar because, they're looking into what the KKK is doing. Civil rights is a whole different thing. I mean, were they looking at into Black Panthers or the militant groups of the civil rights or everybody? You mentioned Dr. King.
Right. Everybody. They did the Panthers, of course, as you might expect, but also the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And Martin Luther King, he was spied on by the FBI. They had you know, they listened to his phone conversations. They put microphones in his hotel rooms. It was just at his house and at his office. Just everything he did was, this is in part because he had criticized the FBI. He didn't think it was doing enough to protect civil rights leaders. And this, you know, offended J. Edgar Hoover to the extent that he became convinced that, King was a Soviet agent, or else why else would he be criticizing the FBI?
Oh, I love it. Oh, my gosh. So did this unearthing of FBI's spying on civil rights, including Dr. King, did this cause a political backlash against the FBI?
It did. And they, you know, they passed some reforms. So, for example, limiting the FBI director to 10 years. So, again, you wouldn't have somebody like Hoover
exactly.
In charge for half a century. You know, under Hoover, there weren't any Black agents or women agents. So gradual diversification of the FBI, new guidelines for them that were issued by the Attorney General to try and, you know, change it from the Hoover personal spy agency into a more professional organization.
Yeah. And all of this is happening in a democracy. So we'll be back after a short break to talk about exactly that, conspiracies in democracies such as our own. We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Olmsted, isn't it strange that we have so many conspiracy theories in our country's history? I mean, we're a democracy.
Right. So you could say that, of course, it makes sense in authoritarian countries for people to have conspiracy theories about.
Exactly, because there's not enough information. But here.
Right. Well, I think that that's because there is a tension between having traditions of democracy and transparency in government on the one hand, but also over the last 100 years, the U.S. government having creating secret agencies, you know, out of necessity in some cases, but having secret agencies that have a lot of secrecy and power, who operate behind the scenes without much democratic accountability. And so as a result, Americans start to wonder what those agencies are up to. And especially when there are things like Watergate or the Church Committee hearings that show that these secret agencies have done things that are illegal or at least questionable, this makes Americans think, well, what else have they been doing that we just haven't heard about yet? So it's this tension and this suspicion of the concentration of secret power.
And then there's the freedom to speak about it. So you start speaking about it and the conspiracy theory starts. In that respect, do conspiracy theories make sense? Are they logical?
Well,
the theory itself, the fact that they happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, a conspiracy theory is a belief that there is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
You haven't been able to prove it yet, right?
Yeah.
Maybe the evidence will emerge at some point. And so certainly there have been times in our history when it has turned out that there were real conspiracies.
Oh.
Watergate would be an example of that.
Yeah.
If you had a couple of reporters at the Washington Post.
Of course.
Who believed that there was a conspiracy in the White House. I don't even think they believed at the beginning that it involved the president, but they believed that it involved high officials. And they were treated as conspiracy theorists by some of their editors. Like, you crazy guys.
Really?
How can you possibly believe that about our government?
Interesting.
And it's only because people within the conspiracy started talking, and there was pressure from the press and from eventually from the Justice Department, and because Nixon taped himself, it's only because of those things that we learned that, in fact, the conspiracy theorists about Watergate, you know, were correct. But it was a true conspiracy.
It was a true conspiracy. Any other examples of wild conspiracy theories that proved to be real?
Well, I would say the other major example would be the Iran-Contra affair. There were reporters in 1985 and 1986 who said, you know what, I know Congress has outlawed the sale of weapons to this army in Nicaragua, but I think people in the White House are still sending them arms anyway. And, you know, it took a long time for them to get the evidence to prove that this was actually happening, that they weren't just wild conspiracy theorists. Mm-hmm.
I guess a third one, I guess, would be the second invasion of Iraq. The second war in Iraq, right?
In that
there were no weapons of mass destruction. Was that a conspiracy theory, though, or was that just we caught our government in a bad act, in a lie?
Right. I think that's what happened. You could say that the Bush administration in many ways deceived the American public about its reasons for going to war in Iraq. But, you know, it wasn't quite the conspiracy that conspiracy theorists alleged, because otherwise if the Bush administration was really involved in a conspiracy to involve Iraq, it probably would have planted weapons of mass destruction and then found them, right?
That would have been really wild as far as conspiracy goes. You know, in this segment, when I started asking you about, well, why do we have conspiracies in our democracy? And you said, Americans wonder. And you said that phrase a couple of times, which makes me wonder, when we use the term Americans and juxtapose that with conspiracy theories, I want to go back to segment number one again. Are these minority of Americans? It seems like, and maybe this is just too simple of an analysis, but it seems like Americans that are just working day and night, they got kids, they got family, we don't even have time for conspiracy theories. I'm speaking from my personal experience.
Right. Well, it depends on which conspiracy theory. I mean, there are political scientists who poll all of these conspiracy theories. And so some of the ones that you hear about a lot are actually not believed by very many people, like, say, the moon landing. About 6% of Americans at various times have said, yes, I think the moon landing was faked. So, you know, very small minority. 9/11, at its peak anyway, there was a pretty good poll in 2006 that showed that 30% of Americans believed that 9/11 had somehow been orchestrated by the Bush administration.
30%?
Yeah. I know, that is astonishing. It's still a minority. Wow. This is astonishing. And Kennedy assassination has been polled over time, so we have really good numbers on that. And the two peaks were in the 1970s and the 1990s, when there were about 80% of Americans, so 4 in 5, who believed that Kennedy had been killed as a result of a conspiracy. Now, I mean, in a way, those questions are a little too broad, because it's like, what kind of conspiracy? Are you saying it was the CIA? Are you saying it's the mob? Are you saying it was the Soviets? You know, those are all very different things.
Yeah. In the first segment of our conversation, we discussed how World War I was a turning point in the history of conspiracy theories in our country. I'm wondering, has Mr. Trump's politics of populism now created another turning point in our history of conspiracy theories, because now you have a president and a former president saying these things.
Right. Yes. So I actually issued a new epilogue for my book in 2019. Oh, that took us up to 2019. Of course, events after 2019, I think.
So we go from World War One to 9/11 and from 9/11 to 2019. Okay.
Right. So, okay. But yes, it was an epilogue on the Trump era, or at least the first 3 years of Trump's administration. And yes, I argued that he really helped legitimize conspiracy theories and the use of conspiracy theories in American politics because he embraced so many of them.
Earlier, I asked you if the fact that conspiracy theories happen makes sense. Not the substance of the conspiracy theory itself, just the fact that they happen. And in a way, I think, makes sense. People react to things that they don't know, or perhaps for entertainment's sake. But going back to my question, Mr. Trump's, peddling in conspiracy theories, does that make sense? I'm not getting into politics. I'm talking about a member of the government, a head of a state, coming up with conspiracy theories about that state.
Well, I suppose it makes sense the way he's doing it, because he's saying that there is a deep state that is, conspiring against him, right? So he's making a distinction. I don't know if he'd be able to explain it this way, but this is the way I understand it. Between the government and the state, right? The state is the permanent part of the bureaucracy, all the government agencies that are there regardless of who is in charge of the administration. And then there's the government, which is temporary. And so
I see.
So he is alleging that the state is conspiring against the government when he is in charge of it.
Have we had that in our history before where, let's say, a senator, a cabinet member, or someone very high up has tried this, that the whole, government, the deep state is conspiring against me?
No, I mean, the closest would be Senator McCarthy, who said that there were spies within the State Department and the White House who were working against America's interests. But that's different than saying the FBI is working against America's interests. And McCarthy never would have said that because he was a huge fan of the FBI.
Yeah. Do you think this turning point created by Mr. Trump in the history of conspiracy theories, is this going to create a whole new era of popularity or of conspiracy theories, or even pushing them into mainstream? What lasting effects do you think this may have?
Oh, I think definitely. I think conspiracy theories have gone from fringe to mainstream just in the last 10 to 15 years. They've always been here. It is saying, even as recently as 9/11, you have, or 5 years after 9/11, you have a third of the public believing this outlandish conspiracy theory about the U.S. government. But what Trump has done is, push that into the mainstream and, make it acceptable, legitimate for the nation's top officials to say these outrageous things.
That could be dangerous because you could say something, it's a theory, you don't have to prove anything. So you all of a sudden put the burden of proof on the government or whoever you're making the conspiracy theory about, and it could spread like wildfire in social media and create real issues, right?
Right. Right. I mean, well, he already has, right? By saying that he actually he's the true winner of the 2020 election.
Yeah.
So he is, sowing distrust about election outcomes, which can be a very dangerous thing in democracies.
And I guess that's one of the fundamental points about conspiracy theories, is that their theories, and they could be said without much evidence. And even when the truth comes out by scientists, by investigators, sometimes the truth is just not as loudly propagated as the conspiracy theory that's been going on for years now, right?
Right.
Yeah, wow. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Olmsted as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Olmsted, how does the Taylor Swift / Kelce conspiracy theory compare to prior conspiracy theories that we talked about?
Well, I'd say that it is a combination of two different kinds of popular conspiracy theories in the United States. First of all, there's the deep state conspiracy theory, right? And the belief that there is this core of people within the government who are conspiring against the people. And so, as I said, this is a theme that I look at in my book that goes back to World War I.
Mm-hmm.
But it especially takes off in the 1990s, say the last 30 years, this fear of the deep state. And Trump talks a lot about the deep state. So you have that. And so the conspiracy theory is that the deep state is rigging the football game so that, Taylor Swift has more prominence, so that then when she, you know, supposedly is going to endorse Joe Biden, that'll get more attention, right? So there's the deep state causing the football game to be rigged. And then on the other hand, there's the long tradition of celebrity conspiracy theories.
Well, we have a long tradition of that.
Yeah. So, you know, there's lots of conspiracy theories about celebrities who died suddenly who actually aren't dead. So Elvis is alive. Tupac is alive. Conversely, that Paul McCartney is dead and that he was replaced with some sort of body double back in the 1960s.
Or Elvis is alive.
Yeah.
You know, I was surprised when you said we have a long tradition of conspiracy theories related to celebrities. Weren't celebrities a movie, Hollywood, also implicated in the McCarthy conspiracy witch hunt? Yeah.
Right. Yes. McCarthy believed that Hollywood was, not just McCarthy, there was actually the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was separate from McCarthy, had a lot of hearings saying that Hollywood was, using its power to shape minds by putting out propaganda, communist propaganda in the movies.
I love it. So if you had a crystal ball about the Taylor Swift / Kelce conspiracy theory, what do you think is going to happen? Is it just going to go away, or is it going to build up more and more up to the election?
I am so bad at predicting. I study the past, and every time I make predictions, they turn out to be wrong. I mean, I thought when Barack Obama was elected and he said, I'm going to be fully transparent, I thought, oh, well, that's the end of conspiracy theories because people won't have anything to worry about because the government's going to be transparent. And in fact, that was another inflection point when things got even crazier. But with that caveat that I'm really bad at this, I wonder if it's just going to run out of steam, because it seems so completely ridiculous, absent any evidence. And of course there's no evidence. I just wonder if it's not going to be something we're talking about in a few months, but who knows?
Who knows? Unless Ms. Swift actually comes out and endorses Biden, or right. God forbid, she says, go vote or something like that. Right. So what are the lessons here for Americans? Here, you and I are talking about conspiracy theories for about an hour.
Right. I would say the lesson is, as we were just discussing a little bit earlier, that they can be fun, they can be entertaining. It's like the Taylor Swift conspiracy theories, they're so absurd that you want to laugh at them.
Yeah.
But actually, they can be very dangerous. So they can endanger groups. When people become convinced that, say, the Jews are out to get them, or African Americans are out to get them, and then there's a mass shooting, you know,
which harks back to some of the conspiracy theories of the 19th century that you were talking about in the first segment of our conversation, right?
Right, exactly. So yeah. they can be very dangerous. They can incite individuals to violence.
Yeah,
you know, and also they can make it difficult for us to tackle collective problems, because if we disagree on, it's not just that we disagree on policies, it's that we disagree on what is truth, what are the facts. And so then it's very hard to have a conversation.
They sort of steal the conversation, right?
Right. Yeah. It hijacks the conversation so that you're no longer having, you know, a respectful disagreement with someone. But you're, you know, accusing your enemy of being a, you know, pedophile, or in league with some of America's enemies, so that it makes it
in
very
a pizza
difficult.
Shop.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It makes it very difficult to solve problems. And then, of course, there's also the fear that, you know, elections could be overthrown, undermined, because of the use. Widespread belief that the deep state is rigging the election.
Yeah. To be sure, there's nothing wrong with having theories and discussing it. They have, that's how science goes forward anyway. As a historian, you may have some ideas about history, but then other historians come out and write books. They confirm it, or they disagree with you, and they debunk whatever theory you or others may have. But that's not how conspiracy theories work. They sort of feed on themselves and they grow. If you want our audience to remember just one point after everything we've talked about conspiracy theories, what would that one point be?
That you can fight this.
Can fight this.
Yeah. I mean, what you need to do as an individual, what you can do is think before you share a post. spread this information, you know, there are fact checking sites out there on the internet. There are some sources that are better than others. You can do your own research, but by doing your own research, don't just like treat every website that you see as equally valid, right? And look at who is the author, who is the source. Are there ways to verify this? Is there peer review? And so therefore, try and stop the spread of conspiracy theories and disinformation.
Don't drink and post on social media. That's another thing. You know, one of the things, if I may share, I've been reading the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal for a long time. And I got to tell you, it's hard. Some of the articles take 15 minutes to read. But the reason I'm bringing that up here, Dr. Olmsted, is that these are research-based articles. Mm-hmm. There are many times that I read an article that I'm like, this is almost history. This is almost not news at all. Because you get the news by the time you wake up because it's popping up on your phone and you can have all sorts of theories. But then you read some of these deeper articles, whether it's in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, wherever you want to read it. Even if you come out disagreeing with the conclusion of that article because the opinion piece or whatever is by someone on the other side of the political spectrum, I think you just come out more learned, and also you start doubting that original theory that you had. I think more Americans perhaps should do that.
Right. And it's getting harder, of course, though, because of the shifting media landscape. The Washington Post, LA Times just laid off, 20% of their staff?
Yeah.
The legacy media, mainstream media are losing readers. And as a result, people are getting more and more of their news from peer-to-peer sharing.
Yeah.
Their, there is none of that tradition of fact-checking. I mean, you might disagree with something in the New York Times, but at least they are supposed to have a devotion to the idea of being objective and looking for the truth. They're not consciously trying to spin things.
Yeah.
And as more and more of those reporters lose their jobs, then what are we left with?
Well, what we're left with is a bunch of pundits, let's say on Fox News, CNN, all these other that are just sharing their opinions versus having someone who's really investigated this. I'm going to age myself here and just say, I miss the days of the Peter Jennings of the world, where, you know, you would get real in-depth news.
Right.
Dr. Olmsted, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much, Dr. Olmsted.
Thank you.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.